Hello, I'm your host Josh, and in this episode I had a conversation with Dr. Harare Kam and Dr. Asligu Aysel about the idea of progress in Islam, which values can prepare us for the future, and how Islamic religious education can be better prepared for a changing world. Dr. Harare Kam is a postdoctoral researcher at the Department of Islamic Theology and Religious Education at the University of Innsbruck. His recent research looks at the epistemological and ethical dimensions of post- and transhumanist ideas through a kalam. His doctoral dissertation at the Goethe University Frankfurt examined Al-Maturidi's theodicy. Dr. Asligu Aysel is a senior researcher at the Department of Islamic Theology and Religious Education at the University of Innsbruck. Her research focuses on Islamic educational and professionalization processes in Germany and Europe. She completed her dissertation on Turkish ways of life in Duisburg at RUB.
Yeah, so we've just finished the Sacred Cyborgs Conference, which was very inspiring. And hopefully we've still got enough energy to record this. And I'm joined by Harare and Asli to discuss how Islamic theology relates to transhumanism and technology, and also in relation to education as well. Harare, if I can start with you. So you've written about the Matrix as an example. How do you view that as an example of the relationship between technology and human beings?
Well, when I first encountered the discourse on post-humanism and transhumanism, of course, as I was reflecting at that time on the cosmological crisis that we are having in Islamic theology. What I mean by it is we don't have a cosmological framework to explain what the human being or the Muslim being is. In former times, we had this Neoplatonism, which explained everything, that the universe is a flow out of God, etc. So we don't have that. And I was looking into what dominates the modern cosmology, and I found myself in transhumanism. But I thought, okay, this is not really a philosophy. What is the cosmology of it? And then I've encountered a paper of David Chalmers, where he's arguing that the Matrix should be considered as the metaphysics of modern times. Matrix as metaphysics, as it's called. And well, first I was baffled, because it suggests that we live in a simulation, in a computer-generated simulation, an idea that I really only knew from the movie Matrix. And it was just a talk, maybe when you go out of the cinema and you joke with friends, hey man, do you think I'm really a simulation? Are we real? But then I saw that it was taken very seriously by philosophers, scientists, physicists, you name it. Neil deGrasse Tyson, an astrophysicist, gave it a 50-50 chance. And then I said, okay, if these people are taking that seriously, if it is a philosophical topic that can be discussed by Oxford philosophers in serious papers, so why couldn't I? So then I took on this task to reflect whether a simulated world in the Matrix could serve as a cosmological framework, as David Chalmers suggested, it, if it could work for a Muslim in the Muslim framework, Islamic theological framework. To my surprise, it did work so well, it got me confused. Because you could start with that God uses a pen, so he's a writing tool, coding tool. Then you have the concept of revelation. God writes to the Lawh al-Mahfuz, the eternal tablet preserved in the eternal heavens, in which the Quran and the revelations are recorded. And then Gabriel comes to this tablet takes whatever he needs, gives it to the prophet, and the prophet translates what he heard from Gabriel to the people. This, you can hear this as an explanation of how coding works. So Gabriel will be the decoder. And and this word will be a simulation, yes, and this would be in line with Islamic theology, because there's the ontological difference between God and man, or God and his creation, meaning God is the eternal, the true one, and everything what he creates is in the status of created, so virtual, if you speak in those terms of simulation theory. So God is the real world, the ultimate world. This world is the virtual world. So what happens when I die? What is the eschatological consequence of this? So we can never merge with God, because he's absolutely distinct from any resemblance to his creation. So what happens? What that suggests would be, we are never leaving the simulation. If we die, if we were good Muslims, we go to the heaven. If we were bad Muslims, we come to a simulation where we will be tortured. So this also resembles kind of reincarnation and so on, in a different level of simulation. And this is also fitting. You could argue, I argued for it in the paper, that you could think in those lines, and you could also write more about it and give more arguments for it. But at the end, the question stays, so what about the truth? I'm only replacing, when I look at it closely, only replacing the terminology and what it means. I'm replacing the Qadim, the eternal, with the real, and the Hadith, the created, with the virtual. So, and I'm saying that Gabriel is a decoder, so angels functioning as a computer, as agents in a computer language. And basically, it comes down to, if you believe that the material backbone of the universe is made up of algorithms, or if you don't believe that. And this question is another question.
Actually, from the Islamic point of view, as you said it, it's really some kind of simulation, the Earth. And they describe it as like a dream. So it feels very realistic, and we feel pain like we do feel pain in our dreams. It feels sometimes so realistic, but then you wake up and you say, oh, it was just a dream, and that's good so. It was not reality. From the Islamic point of view, this thought is even relies on this earth. That means the earth is even some kind of simulation, some kind of virtual.
And this argument is also supported when you look at the Quran and you look what death means. Look for nothingness in the Quran. Whether you die and go into nothingness, there is no concept of nothingness in the Quran. If you die, the death is described as a kind of a state of drunkenness, a state of unconsciousness. So it is not a state of you dead and gone. You transformed your state of being into a state of delirium, if you want. And then you will be waking up from your delirium to another world. So this goes so good in the line with simulation theory. It's scary.
Yeah, and there's also another Quran verses, Al-Imran. There it says, verily every being shall taste death.
With this presentation of the world as a simulation, where does that leave the idea of freedom? Do we still have freedom as human beings? Or is everything determined? And how does that relate to Islamic theology?
So from an Islamic point of view, the question of free will is a so discussed topic. Yeah, this is one of the most discussed topics in Islamic ethics, maybe, and in Kalam, in systematical dogma theory. So, but the main thought is, you have a free will, but God knows this, where it goes to, how you will decide yourself. Because it's On the other hand, it's so simple because God is beyond space and time. Of course he knows it.
Well, in the realm of, as I said, when I change the discourse on the question of the nature of reality and the afterlife, I'm just changing the paradigms and transforming it and bringing it to the modern language of philosophy of mind and computer language, which dominates the philosophical discourse. So what does it tell about the truth of religious belief? As Asli just mentioned, well, the problem of freedom of will is a deep-rooted problem. It is not a solved problem. You will find more arguments against the existence of free will, more plausible arguments than you would find for the existence of free will. At the same time, it is a necessity that we would have free will because of the eschatological judgment of God. So within this annihilation theory, the story wouldn't change. The difficulties would be presented in a different way, but the story wouldn't change. Why wouldn't it change? Because we have a simulator, and the simulator invented a program. The program is written in code, and in code he designed this universe as to follow some algorithms. You can now interpret the natural laws as the algorithms, underlying algorithms of the simulation world. And we would be part of these algorithms of this world. So our bodies would follow the algorithms of the natural law. So this is what happens in normal life also. But now you would say, okay, since I am part of this algorithm, which is written by the simulator, the all-knowing simulator, and so can I even be sure that he gave me a free rein within the algorithm? He wouldn't have the interest to do so, I guess, because it would be a possibility that I'm evolving to a virus that destroys his algorithms. I think the simulator wouldn't like that option. So it would be discussed under different preconditions. But essentially, we would talk, run into the same walls.
And I would like to admit, Muslims view this life as an examination of God. So we are on Earth just for a period of time, and we go through this examination. And without a free will, it doesn't make a sense that we go through this examination if God determines everything. So, if we talk about fate, Qadar in Arabic. So there is a mutlaq, an absolute qadar, fate, and the muallaq, the undecided one. So, and you see the point. You are able as a human being, if you do your prayings and you're praising God, and if you do good deeds, this seems to be very, to me very important, good deeds. Then if you wish to have a longer life, for example, God will give you the permission if he wants to. If he wants to, he will give you the permission. Because in this case, I want to bring a hadith. It says, the Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, was asked, who is the best person? He replied, the one whose life is long and whose deeds are good. When asked, who is the worst person, he answered, the one whose life is long, but those deeds are bad. You see, this hadith emphasizes that the true value in life in Islam lies not in its length, but in the righteousness of one's actions. So if you want to, you can have a longer life, you can have a longer examination on this earth, but honestly, why should you? So it doesn't matter if you have a longer life or not. It's more matters to do the right, righteousness.
If I can relate that to progress in two dimensions. So we've got, on the one hand, we've got the idea of, is there an idea of moral progress? In that as you live your life, you can become a better person. And then also the other side of it is, how does that relate to technological progress?
First, I just thought after you talked about the hadith, I'll go back quickly to freedom of will. I think I like the approach of Imam Abu Mansur Maturidi the most. He is, I wrote my PhD on him. He was, he's a, one of the two authoritative figures of Sunnite Islam from the formative period. They were the basic forefathers of Islamic theological thought. So, and he, when he looked at how freedom of will was discussed, he saw that Mu'tazilites and Asharites were getting in each other's hairs because they couldn't, they lost themselves in theory. He said, okay, now you're discussing whether an atom has six parts or eight parts, and what does it have to do with free will anymore? And they did it as to say, as to what is the phenomenology of free will, that was the discussion. Maturidi says, if you can show something with your fingers, you don't need an extra theoretical foundation for it to prove its existence. So force a five-year-old child to pray, and he will run away. So in his act of running away, you will see his free will, you can show it. Why does he run away? Because he wants to play, he not pray. So he says, this is, you know, it shows yourself. This is free will in action. I don't need to prove it to you that it exists. I can show it to you. If you need a theoretical proof, well, go on. Do your research, but you will most likely find arguments against it, but it doesn't disprove what I can show you, that it exists. So that's free will.
Great, thank you. And how is there progress within technology and in the world, and also in terms of moral progress?
During the conference, we had a deep discussion, in fact, during dinner with Stefan Sorgner and Professor Hoff, who are, of course, one of the biggest minds in this field. And yeah, Stefan Sorgner presented his idea of Eurotranshumanism, where he distinguishes himself from classical transhumanism, which are represented by figures like Elon Musk and Nick Bostrom and the Silicon Valley actors, agents. And he expressed his dislike of these figures and of their mindset. Professor Hoff, of course, agreed with it. So where does it lead you, your criticism? And he said, it's Eurotranshumanism, where we reject this kind of unregulated progress, where he said we have to develop responsibly and taking our environment and our futures into account. And well, it gets so close to critical posthumanist approach, and critical posthumanists are really the enemies of transhumanist pursuit, if you so will. So critical posthumanists, they are against progress, constant progress, and against anthropocentrism. And these are the basic two tenets of humanist thought. So humanist thought is carried by transhumanist thought. So as Stefan Sorgner made this move from classical to Eurotranshumanism, so where does it lead this progress? And I expressed my suspicions about the term progress, because I would say we should distinguish between, for example, if we can produce plastic now, and plastic is something that is not given in nature as such, there is a lot of human ingenuity and engineering involved in producing those plastics. Is this a progress? Well, if you look at what you can do with plastic, of course, it's a progress. It's something that was never there before. But if you look at what costs, you did get your enhanced medical devices and computers and so on. Well, scientists now talk of the Anthropocene, that live in the Anthropocene era, meaning that humankind will lead through its own efforts to its own this extinction. So the way that it's leading to our own extinction, can it be a way that leads forward, and can we truly name it progress? One thought about how this relates to theology. So the term progress becomes more tricky if we consider how theology works. Well, how does theology work? Where does the truth lie in? So where did it all begin? In the revelation. God revealed his truth to the prophet Muhammad, and he revealed it to us. Can there be any progress in this divine knowledge? All our philosophies now gather together and think of the revelation, can we say that we extended our knowledge, that we produced more knowledge that we didn't know before? Well, of course, the theological stance is the perfect state of this knowledge was in the time and event of the revelation itself, where the prophet spoke. And if you, the prophet, you cannot trump the knowledge of the prophet. So if anything, then we have a degress since the time of the revelation in our knowledge and closeness of spiritual wisdom, because we move away from the prophet, we move away from his wisdom and his knowledge, we produce more books and no less. So this is also a problem in talking about progress.
And Islam sees views science positively, but as long as it benefits humanity, the maslaha principle, and it aligns with ethical principles such as justice, adl, and benevolence, ihsan, and harm prevention, darar. So as long as it aligns with these two principles, maslaha and ethical standards of Islam, it's okay. But you can't just do progress or science for a group of people, for elite maybe, and by causing harm for a majority of other people. Yeah? In this case, the maslaha principle is not there.
Mm. Yeah, thank you. That brings me on to my next point, I guess, about what do you think are the important... You've already mentioned the two or three values that are important for governing how we deal with technology, or how we can do that. What do you identify as the key values from Islamic theology that would benefit society as a whole, maybe, in terms of dealing with technology in an ethical way?
So when it comes to ethical values in Islam, ikhlas, that means actions that should be done with pure intentions and for the sake of God, not for personal gain and public recognition. The second one is truthful and honesty, sadiq. That means Islam emphasizes the importance of speaking the truth, fulfilling promises, and avoiding deceit. Justice and fairness is another one, adl. Ensuring fairness, it means in all dealings, treating others equitably and upholding justice, yeah. And compassion and mercy, rahma, that means kindness towards others, including family, neighbors, and even strangers. Trustworthiness, amana, that means fulfilling one's duties and responsibilities with integrity, whether in personal relationships, business, and transactions. And even we are even the khilafa of a trustee of God here on earth. That means we have the responsibility for all these things I'm talking about. When I should go with the ethical values, then it comes to respect for human dignity, karama. That means Islam upholds the inherent dignity of every human being, regardless of race, religion, or social status. Then we have tawadu'a, modesty and humility. That means avoiding arrogance and pride, and recognizing that knowledge, wealth, and status. Patience and perseverance, sabr, enduring hardships with resilience, maintaining self-control and not reacting impulsively, generosity and charity, ithar and sadaqa, giving to those in need, sharing resources and practicing selflessness. And the last one that I could mention is environmental responsibility, khilafah. That means Islam considers humans as trustees, stewards of the earth, emphasizing sustainability and ethical treatment of nature and resources.
Maybe to give some background, okay, pause. Maybe to give some background to what you said, it is a very difficult question to determine what the Islamic part in ethics is. So I teach the seminar Ethics in Islam, and this is the question that we deal the whole semester with. But just as it started, Asla just mentioned the most prominent virtues that Muslim theologians put forward, and she mentioned several times karama and sidq and sadaqa, which basically mean generosity and so on. Well, at the time before the revelation, or at the time of the revelation, the virtues for the Meccan pagan Arabs, one of the highest virtues was karama. So it's not something that the Quran invented, but what they did understand on the karama, generosity, was that if you want to be known as a generous person and raise your social status, you should organize a big party where you should invite the elites, and you should spend a lot of money and make everything possible, every desire be fulfilled, even if it means that you destroy yourself financially. You have to do this in order to gain your social status. This was meant by karama. Spend and give for big parties and show you belong to the elite. And then the Quran came and said, well, karama is that you be humble and take care of your others, not to spend inflatiously on hedonistic practices. You see, so the meaning of what generousness meant has been transformed already during the time of Revelation. That was the reason why pagan Meccans were so against, that there was enemy of Muhammad. What happened afterwards in the development of the civilization was you get influences from Greek virtue ethics. You have these Neoplatonic ideas that flows in into what's considered to be characteristic of Muslim virtues. You have the intentional ethics that we learn from the Prophet, that your intention counts. And you have your legal ethics that determines you have to pray 5 times. And if you do not, you're a sinful person, so that's not virtuous. So after that, it becomes very tricky to determine, because if you would look at these virtues that you just mentioned, I guess Christian theologians would come up with the same or similar virtues. So what is the Islamic of it? So this is the tricky part to answer. But every religion has also its historical rootedness. And from the authoritative figure of our Prophet, we derive what we try to learn again and again. What would the Prophet do? And if you ask this question in your acting, maybe you're acting like a Muslim.
So, Asi, in your paper and in your research, you've looked at religious education, and I think yesterday you said that there's a deficiency in the teaching of these values. Could you say more about Why do you think there's a problem in teaching values in education? And what are the challenges within that, and how can we address them?
So, yeah, first of all, I have to say, I'm in this field of Islamic religious pedagogy, and I see it a little bit more wider. Yeah, that means I deal with, first of all, with the question, what is Islamic knowledge? That means, what are the contents of Islam? And the second part is, what is transferred to next generations from these contents? So what do we pick up and transfer, and how do we do this? So the didactics. And when it comes to new technologies like transhumanism and posthumanism, then comes a third part, the adaptation. What is this? What we are talking about, when we're talking about transhumanism or posthumanism, or maybe different things, and if it aligns with Islamic thought, how can we adapt it into Islamic teachings? And you see, there is even a progress, yeah. And in this case, or when you look into the curricula, when you look into the classrooms where Islamic education is taking place, you see that they are not really equipped for new technologies, for adaptation into the curricula. So the teachers will be so overwhelmed with the new technologies or new philosophies behind these new technologies. And the question is here always, does it goes hand in hand with the Islamic thought? Because transhumanism can also be dangerous when it comes to this discussion to immortality, maybe. Yeah, immortality or to replacing God with a mankind. Then it gets a little bit, not a little bit, it gets very dangerous because Islam is God-centric. And I see that there are some topics in the curricula where we just put maybe these new technologies, maybe AI, yeah. And even there, we really don't know what AI is producing about Islam. Which knowledge do we have of Islam when we just typing some things about Islam in AI, yeah? And these programs, yeah, they are even so various, so different. They are from America to China, so different. And the fact is, the Islamic religious education at schools, they are not equipped for these new technologies and for the philosophy behind these new technologies. And the question here for me is, as a researcher in this field, how can we put this together, maybe, so that we even don't get in contradiction with Islamic teachings?
Thank you. That sounds fascinating. If you could give a recommendation for teachers about how to respond to it, because I feel like this isn't just a problem with Islamic religious education, but it's a problem within education as a whole, because there's so much new technology at the moment. Teachers are dealing with the question, okay, you know, students are using AI, how do we respond to that? Would you have a suggestion or recommendation?
Yeah, I would have it. The thing that I would can say or recommend is, to my mind, we need to integrate more Islamic teachings, I mean didactics, into the Islamic religious education. That means maybe the concept of tafakkur, to think and reflect. We don't have this. We don't have tafakkur, but we have critical thinking. But it's not the same. Yeah. So is Islam encouraged to think about the things and reflect the things, but reflection and critical thinking is, as I said, not the same. So if we, first of all, I think even the students should have more knowledge in these disciplines of Islam, I mean in jurisprudence, fiqh, in philosophy, in kalam, systematical dogma in Tasawwuf, in Sufism, mysticism. And if you see it like glasses, you should put on the glass of philosophy or the glasses of jurisprudency, and then you should to put all the glasses on together. And if you have a bright view through these glasses, then you have your Islamic thought, I think. Yeah. And this is the case. We should transfer main subjects, main contents of these disciplines, first of all, and then to bring it together to have a holistic perspective. I think this is something that what Islamic religious education can even bring, teach the students.
Thank you. Yeah, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
This interview was recorded in Innsbruck as part of the conference Sacred Cyborgs, Exploring the Intersection of Artificial Intelligence, Transhumanism and Religion. The conference was organized by the Department of Islamic Theology and Religious Education at the University of Innsbruck and took place from the 7th to the 9th of February 2025.